Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today I want to welcome Mark Devlin. He is a UK-based club and radio DJ, music journalist, and author. In 2010, he underwent a conscious awakening, bringing a new awareness of what's really going on in the world. His special area of interest was how this ties to the mainstream music industry and the way in which A-list artists have been used to manipulate and mind control the masses in line with a much larger agenda. He now presents public talks on these subjects, as well as appearing on radio and producing two regular podcast series. He's also the author of Musical Truth, its follow-up volume 2, and an allegorical novel, The Cause and the Cure. Mark, welcome. How are you doing today?
Hey, Chris. Good to connect with you in these very strange and uncertain times. I'm doing about as well as anyone could under house arrest and martial law, which is what we've got at the moment. So who would ever have thought that it would come to this? But here we are, and we have to deal with it.
Yes, exactly. We are in a very profound situation. Something we've never seen before. And I do want to touch on that a little bit, but I brought you here today because we're going to talk about the darker side of the music industry. And there is a very dark side to the music most Americans enjoy, as well as movies and TV shows, of course. And I believe that they're all, of course, connected, from CIA manipulation to occult and satanic rituals. And from the earliest days, it was about culture creation and steering society. And music is, you know, one way to steer society, and also is a deadly pandemic. So before we get into your work tonight, I'd kind of like to get your thoughts on what may be going on behind the scenes right now.
Well, whatever is going on, it won't be what we're getting told by the mainstream media and the governments of the world. So anything those institutions ever tell me, if I want to find the truth of a situation, I generally look in the opposite direction to what I'm being told by these professional paid liars, because governments and mainstream media outlets have shown themselves time and time again to be full of lies, spin, and propaganda, and they're not to be trusted. So I don't buy the official version of what's going on for a second, that we've got this deadly pandemic that just came out of nowhere. Nobody could have foreseen it. It seems to have arisen out of bats in China. Don't buy a word of it. As to whether there is a real virus going around, I'm getting conflicting stories on this and conflicting opinions from everyone that I speak to. Some people seem to think that this virus is very real, that it's been cooked up in a laboratory somewhere and deliberately unleashed, and I can't rule that out. Then there are other people who think that the whole thing is a put-up job, a hoax, and what we're actually looking at is a strain of the flu, which comes along every year round about this time, kills a bunch of people, has for as far back as we know, particularly older people. And what we're seeing is the same that we do every year. Thousands of people just dying of the flu or a strain of the common cold. And it's being dressed up to be something that it's not. It's being given this scary new name of COVID-19, coronavirus, and it's being used as an excuse and a justification to bring in all kinds of draconian totalitarian measures, which tick so many boxes on the New World Order wish list that those of us that are into alternative research have known about for many years. Just look at how society has been changed in the past few weeks in the name of this coronavirus outbreak, so-called. We've got increased monitoring and surveillance. We've got restrictions on our personal freedoms of movement, which are actually natural God-given rights that no man or woman has any business in trying to take away. So long as you're doing no harm, I might add. You have an absolute right to freedom of movement, freedom of assembly. But they're trying to shut all that down. We're being told that we can't associate with other people. We've got to stay in our homes in collective punishment, which is what we're undergoing. We're getting word that a vaccine is on the way, which is supposed to be the cure to this whole thing, to make sure that it never arises in the same way again. So that's another red flag for those that have been paying attention to what the controllers of this world have been trying to introduce for so long. We've got the gradual deletion of cash So we're being told that, you know, banknotes could spread the virus. So the safest thing is to use electronic currency and contactless wherever possible, which is another thing they've been trying to introduce for years and years and years. So it seems to me that so many things are now getting introduced on a mandatory basis, blamed on this pandemic or plandemic, as people are calling it. And there's way more to it than just a virus that has got out of control. As to where it's all headed, a lot of people are saying this is the big push that the controllers have been looking to justify for so long. I don't actually feel that's the case. I do feel that this is temporary, and I do feel that it's going to pass. I can't say how long that will be. My best guess is that these restrictions will be in place for a few weeks yet. But from some of the things I've seen and heard, it seems to be the case that it's already planned for this to be lifted sometime around June or July in most parts of the world. I then think we are going to see a drastically changed society. We're going to see people with radically different social attitudes to each other, and by and large, people's behaviours are going to have changed. They'll have been shaped and moulded and entrained to be very different to what they were before. And I think we've got some challenges ahead. But being forearmed with the knowledge of what's really going on and having a bit of background information in terms of what these psychopathic individuals that are behind this whole thing have wanted to achieve for so long is going to stand us in very good stead for navigating the times ahead. So I'm not some doomsday merchant that thinks this is it and we're all finished. It is going to pass, and we have to be very alert and very vigilant to the kind of society that we're going to emerge into when this is all over.
Yes, I mean, and it seems to me it's another way to shape society in a certain direction. And, you know, like you, I do have a hopes that after this, we can get back to somewhat of a normal society, and things could possibly even end up better in the future. Who knows? But before we get into anything else, tell us what got you started down your path. When did you first start, opening up and realizing that things aren't as we're told?
Well, it's been 10 years now. It was 2010 when I first woke up to all these truths. And it was a gradual process. It wasn't a singular event that set me off down this path. I had been questioning the ways of the world for 2 or 3 years up to that point, from around about 2007. I just started to pay attention to what was going on around me, and a lot of things didn't make sense. I had a lot of unanswered questions. There seemed to be a lot of injustice in the world. There seemed to be situations arising which could have been avoided if the will had been there on the part of certain governments to avoid them. So this got me questioning the true nature of those that claim to be our rulers. And it got me into all kinds of alternative research, most notably the books of David Icke. So I absorbed a lot of his work around about 2007, 2008. And in 2010, when he brought out his book, Human Race, Get Off Your Knees, I read that book. I was actually on a trip to the United States. I'd come to New York and Buffalo, Niagara Falls, and I had a bit of time to just read while I was on the planes and in hotel rooms. And everything just seemed to come together for me then. Everything made sense. It was like I'd put all the pieces together to a giant jigsaw puzzle. And I came to some quite profound comprehensions about the true nature of what this reality is, who's really running things, and the way daily human life is nothing like we've spent our entire lives being entrained to think it is. And I realize that this filters down to every single aspect of our daily experiences. And the one that I was particularly interested in finding out more about was the corporate music industry, having worked in it. I came to comprehend that this institution, like so many others, is used for mind control and social engineering and sowing certain attitudes and belief systems in the minds of the general public. And I figured that there had been a reason why I'd become a music guy. There had been a reason why I'd trodden the path that I had for the previous couple of decades. And I really felt as if my life had some meaning and some purpose in terms of me becoming someone that would expose the way this industry works and the nefarious ends for which it's used. I just felt that was my role in life. And so I've been fulfilling that role now for 10 years, and it's completely changed everything that I do in terms of what went before. I've put out my two books, Musical Truth Volumes 1 and 2, and they brought together pretty much everything I've come to understand about the true nature of these industries and the way it ties into everything else. And it really does, you know, just going back to our opening comments there about the situation in the world with this so-called pandemic, the same groups, networks, individuals that are driving the narrative of this coronavirus situation are exactly the same groups, networks, and individuals that are ultimately controlling the entertainment industry and the world of politics and the world of medicine and science and big business and the military and academia and every other aspect of daily human life. These groups, these networks have had a very long time to get their fingers in all these pies and to subvert and infiltrate and hijack all of them. And this is the dynamic that we face in the world at this time. And very few people seem to accept this or understand that this is the case. But I think the more we get situations like the one we're all finding ourselves in now, the more people are going to start questioning the true nature of this reality and how it seems so different to what we've been trained to think of it as.
Now, how far back can we trace this manipulation and basically weaponization of the music industry? You know, I guess we could start with where the CIA became involved, because that's where it went sour, right?
Well, we can trace it all the way back. When I first started in this research, I made the very naive mistake of thinking that this infiltration was something that had taken place in recent decades. And as I delved further into the research, I found myself going further and further back, all the way to the formation of the popular music industry. And by way of a time frame, I kind of pinpoint that as the mid-1950s. That's when we got the birth of the rock and roll era. So we saw Bill Haley and the Comets with Rock Around the Clock, which was a groundbreaking record, very different to anything that had gone before. Straight after that, you had the emergence of Elvis Presley, that huge phenomenon. Then you had all the rock and roll acts, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard and Buddy Holly and all these. Then as the 50s gave way to the 60s, you had groups like the Beatles coming through and the Rolling Stones. And then from the mid to late 1960s, you had the counterculture movement, the flower power hippie psychedelic scene, which birthed a whole slew of new acts onto the scene in conjunction with so many social changes that were happening at the time. And as you just pointed out there, the fingerprints of the CIA were all over it. But just going back to those early days of the 1950s, I mean, you could take it back even further. A lot of people have suggested to me that I research some of the classical music greats. Now, classical music isn't really my thing. I don't know much about it. It would take a lot of research on my part to uncover some stuff there. But people have suggested that many of these prominent composers like Beethoven and Mozart and all these big names were all Freemasons. And there was probably manipulation going on with that kind of music in terms of what was getting loaded into it and the way it was affecting people on a subliminal level. But my area of interest kind of begins from the 1950s onwards. And what we find there with a lot of the early record labels that these acts came out on, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, all these big names, is that they all have a grounding in the world of the military or the military industrial complex. So you can look at labels like RCA, which actually stands for Radio Corporation of America. And that was a development that came out of the US Navy. Before it became a record label, that company was involved in sound technology for military applications, like radio and sonar technology and this kind of thing. Then you have EMI, Electrical Mechanical Industries, which has a similar background with military applications. And it's the same with all the big prominent early record labels like Decca and Parlophone. A past can always be traced back to applications that go into the world of the military. So we've got our first indicator there that there's a little bit more to know about what is supposed to be an industry all about entertainment. And then when you get into the backgrounds of some of the prominent musicians themselves, you find families that are steeped in the security services. It might be the CIA, the FBI, the Pentagon. Over here in Britain, it would be connections to MI5, MI6, the Tavistock Institute. You find fathers of prominent musicians who were generals or admirals or high-ranking military guys, and this puts a rather different slant on where all these artists came from. It really blows apart the idea that these musicians were just guys who got lucky. They put together a band, they wrote a few catchy songs, they perfected a few guitar riffs, they punted a few demo tapes around, and they just happened to get lucky, and they just happened to become the cultural phenomenon that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones did. So when you diligently do the research and you delve into some of these backgrounds and some of these affiliations, you start to see trends and patterns emerging, and you realize that the entertainment industry and the music industry specifically have been weaponized. They're military grade operations. They're there for social engineering. They're there to change culture, change attitudes and behaviors in the general public. They go hand in hand with other social engineering operations that come out of institutions like the Tavistock Institute and the CIA. And you realize that that's what the entertainment industry has been about all along. And the music industry works hand in hand with Hollywood movies and the television industry. And if there's one phrase to describe what the real role is of all these different institutions, it's mass mind control.
Yes, definitely. And you mentioned that a lot of these, you know, famous rock stars, actors, have military and even CIA ties. Could you talk a little bit more about that, possibly get into some examples?
Yeah, well, the very best example that we have of an individual that is held up as a rock music icon and a poster child for the sort of psychedelic counterculture scene would be Jim Morrison of The Doors. And this is a story that's often told, but like I say, it just illustrates the point wonderfully. So it was uncovered by Dave McGowan, an author and researcher who put out a book called Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon a few years ago. Sadly, Dave has passed away now. He's no longer with us, but he left behind this incredible legacy in his work. And this book concerns the Laurel Canyon district of Los Angeles and the unfeasible amount of musicians who became prominent voices on the counterculture scene of the mid to late 1960s who just happened to all congregate in that area. And McGowan uncovered the fact that in that neighborhood, you've got a covert military research base known as Lookout Mountain that was involved in lots of kind of black ops on behalf of the military, specifically making propaganda films. There are a whole bunch of movies that were produced out of Lookout Mountain. So that's right there in the middle of this community where all these musicians just flocked at that time. And some incredible social changes were going on. You had the emergence of LSD and various other, you know, psychedelics and entheogens that were just coming along. At this time, you had changed attitudes towards sex and family and relationships. You had the arrival of the birth control pill, the birth of feminism at the hands of Gloria Steinem, who turns out to have been an asset of the CIA. And when you look into where all the LSD came from, that was getting freely distributed at all these hippie gatherings and all these big music festivals like the Monterey Pop Festival in summer 67 and all these others, you find out that for the most part, it was coming out of the CIA. And the agency had infiltrated all these different scenes and these communities. It had put its agents in to distribute the LSD to change society and change culture and change attitudes. So this was all going hand in hand with the music, which from round about 1965 onwards really changed and became far out and trippy and psychedelic. And all these groups that were at the forefront of that, McGowan showed in his book, almost without exception, you can find that the fathers had roles in the Navy, the Army, the Marines, they were connected to the Defense Department, the CIA, various other expressions of government. And when it wasn't that, it would be coming out of Ivy League universities like Harvard and Yale. It would be connections to secret society fraternities like the Century Club, the Bohemian Club, Freemasonry. And like I say, with Jim Morrison, the Doors, it turns out that his father was a Navy admiral, very high ranking, by the name of George Stephen Morrison. And he just happened to be the guy that was in control of the fleet of ships involved in the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which springboarded America into the Vietnam War. So you got the father out there creating all this havoc and hell, and you got his son, Jim Morrison, being put out there as a poster child for the counterculture scene, which is supposed to be all about anti-war and anti-establishment. So how do you reconcile those two things? And if this were an isolated example, you could maybe write it off as just one of these strange occurrences that we get in life from time to time. But it's very far from an isolated incident. And then just taking it through the decades, we have so many examples of musicians and groups that have CIA connections. Another good example would be the group The Police, the drummer for which was a guy named Stuart Copeland. And when you look into his family, you find that the patriarch of that family, Miles Copeland Sr., was a big-time CIA operative. He was a career agency guy that had postings in various parts of the world. The Copeland boys, he had three sons, Ian, Stuart, and Miles Jr., and they were all born in Beirut, Lebanon, where Miles Copeland was stationed out there in one of his CIA roles. So then we have Stuart Copeland later cropping up as the drummer in The Police, and you have the two other brothers, Miles Copeland Jr. and Ian, who both become music industry executives. They run various different companies, and they very much have a stranglehold on the whole punk and new wave scene, which emerged towards the end of the 1970s, going into the 80s. That family very much controlled the path that that particular music genre took. And another thing that I've told many times, but it bears repeating, is the fact that they often give us little clues and indicators for those with the eyes to see and with a critical mind to think of, you know, where these people come from. So they had a holding company which was known as Copeland International Artists, the initials for which are, of course, CIA. So it's as if they're letting us know where they've come from. Then they had a company called Frontier Booking International, which was used to book gigs for many of the artists on their roster, and the initials there work out as FBI. They also had a company called International Records Syndicate, or IRS, and then of course you have The Police with Sting, the lead singer, as in a sting operation. So one thing you do find when you throw yourself into this kind of research is the controllers of these institutions do like to mock us. They see most people as ignorant and profane and in spiritual darkness, because these people are occultists. They're high-level occultists when you get down to it. They adhere to religious belief systems. They adhere to dark occult rituals. It gets very deep. And they see the vast majority of us as, you know, useless eaters, just the general ignorant brain dead public, and they do like to morbidly mock us, and they often give us little clues and indicators as to what we're really looking at. And when you can learn to spot the signs and the patterns and the symbols, you discover some very interesting things.
And you just mentioned the occult aspect. We see all these celebrities and rock stars doing their symbolism, the one eye, the pyramid. I mean, they don't even hide this anymore. They don't even try and make it vague, the symbolism that they're using in movies, TV, music nowadays. But do you think these artists that are doing this really are entrenched in this mystery school knowledge? They really know anything at all, or are they just puppets just being manipulated?
Well, I think there are levels to it. So there are going to be a lot of foot soldiers who are basically dupes. They are puppets. They are stooges. They're not in full comprehension of what it is they're ensconced in. They're given orders and directions by their handlers. So in many cases, their managers will actually be their handlers. This feeds into trauma-based mind control programming as well, which is an area that I've looked into deeply. It turns out that many of these A-list celebrity pop artists that we've all heard of will have undergone mind control programming. So they're so much easier to direct and control in that way. They're not operating to their own agendas. They're adhering to things that have been laid out and set out for them. So in many cases, when they're flashing up these signs and symbols in pop videos and at award shows and when they're on stage, in many cases, they're doing it subconsciously because it's been programmed into them. And it just becomes a subliminal reaction. And then in other cases, they will have been simply instructed to do it. They've been told what kind of costumes and what garb to get into. They've been told what kind of theme their stage show is going to take. And they've been told what to do at a particular point in the performance. And a lot of them would not be in full knowledge of what it is they're doing. But then you get the very prominent, very successful household name artists that we've all heard of. And I would suggest that when you get to this level, these people know exactly what it is they're involved with. So Jay-Z would be an example. Jay-Z, I would suggest, is an adept occultist to a certain degree. So when he's flashing up his rock sign, so-called, this triangle of manifestation, which is what it actually is, although it's passed off as representing a diamond, that's what the fans are told, I would argue that he knows exactly what he's doing. You've got guys like Paul McCartney, whoever he may be. I mean, this is a whole different subject area. There's a very strong suggestion that the guy that is presented to us as Paul McCartney today is either not the original Paul McCartney or is one of two individuals that has been playing the public role all these years. That's a whole different rabbit hole to get into. But if we just accept that it's this one individual that is referred to as Paul McCartney, now, he would be a very deeply entrenched key player, and he would know exactly what it is he's involved with. And, you know, he's got some high level knowledge there. Same would go for somebody like Mick Jagger. I mean, really, all the sirs, when you look at British artists that have been around for decades, you've got Sir Mick Jagger, you've got Sir Elton John, Sir Paul McCartney, Sir Tom Jones. All these artists that have been knighted, Sir Cliff Richard. You don't get a knighthood like that unless you're a very key player and unless you've proven yourself to be someone who is trusted to stick with the program for the rest of your days. And then with American artists, you could apply the same thing. You know, somebody like Bob Dylan is an obvious example. And you could argue the case for somebody like Bruce Springsteen, maybe, you know, artists that have been around for decades. Madonna, certainly, is a high-level occultist. I mean, it's even on public record that she's into Kabbalah, and she practices that particular, you know, system. But she's into some very dark stuff as well. The symbolism that she's employed over the years has been deeply satanic, Luciferian, and she's pushed so many social engineering agendas as well. Whenever there's an agenda that needs to be propped up, whether it's the pushing of the transgender agenda, transhumanism, most recently she's weighed in with this whole coronavirus COVID-19 thing. She made a video a couple of weeks ago claiming that she was self-isolating at home. I'm pretty sure it was coded language she was using because it was quite ambiguous. I think if you know what words and phrases to listen out for, you would have got something else from that message that the general fans did. But she then goes on to mock us, again an example of this morbid mockery that we get, by saying that she's working on a Smith Corona typewriter, of all things, just bringing forth that word Corona. We had the same thing from Tom Hanks. So Tom Hanks and his wife supposedly contracted the coronavirus while they were in Australia. They were out there doing some work, and we're told that they fell ill and they decided to self-isolate as an example to us all, you know, because whatever our idol celebrities do, we should do in deference to them. And then in one of his posts, he mentions that he's got a typewriter with him because he collects typewriters, and it just happens to be a Smith Corona typewriter. I mean, we all pack a typewriter when we go on holiday, don't we? It's just a standard part of our luggage. We've all done it, let's face it. So to my thinking, it's just mockery. And like I say, whenever there's an agenda that needs to be propped up, what better way to get inside the public consciousness than to use tried and trusted celebrities who, unfortunately, people look up to? So people will pay attention to what somebody like Tom Hanks says and what somebody like Madonna says. And that's the purpose for which they're used.
Now, we hear words like Satanism and the occult and satanic rituals, but can we really get a bead on what they're actually worshiping? I mean, is it really Satanism? Is it something older? It seems to be a mix of these ancient type of religions, but using the darkest side of it, I would think.
Well, it does seem to be. Satanism, at its core, is an ideology and a state of mind, and it's all about service to self rather than service to the rest of creation. So the word Satan, coming from the Hebrew and also the Arabic word shatain, means the opposer or the adversary when you translate it in those cultures. And what it's referring to is it's opposing the godly nature of man. So you can choose to align yourself with creation, with the creator itself, or you can choose to go against that and worship the individual, the ego, the carnal beast that exists within all men and women. So that's what Satanism is, and we find this being propagated a lot through entertainment and culture. Various different examples of that. But then there's Luciferianism, which is kind of connected to it, but it's a little bit more dark in what it involves. And this particular belief system has its own rituals, and we see a lot of these being played out at shows like the Super Bowl halftime show and the Grammys and these various award shows that we get. In recent years, these events have been getting darker and darker and more obviously occult in what they're presenting to us. And there's been lots of analysis done on sites like Vigilant Citizen, which is a great resource, but many other researchers get into it as well. And they show exactly what's being enacted at these things. There are many different religious belief systems from the ancient world that seem to be getting evoked in some of these stage performances. And even mainstream publications and outlets have started commenting on how dark and satanic some of these shows are getting. So even they're starting to notice. I mean, the Eurovision Song Contest last year was very dark. Madonna was wheeled out for that one in her new Madame X persona with the eye patch and everything that that evokes. And she was talking about, she did this song that had this jolly, catchy kind of reggae beat with this guest artist. So on the surface of it, it just seems to be this pleasant song. But when you get inside the lyrics that she was putting across, she was talking about population reduction. And she was saying things like, not all of you are going to make it into the future. So you've got to wonder whether she had some advanced knowledge of what was going to happen this year with this plandemic back then in May 2019 when she was doing that stage show. So, you know, people might like to ask themselves what any of this stuff is doing in what is supposed to be all about fun and entertainment, because that's what pop music is supposed to be, right? It's supposed to be something that you listen to in your downtime, you unwind to, you sing along to a few catchy songs, go along to some shows to see your favorite artist perform, you know, and just forget all your worries and let your hair down. But we're seeing anything but that now in terms of what these A-list artists are being used to promote. It's very dark. It is satanic. It is Luciferian. It's very occult. And people have no idea what effect this is having on their subconscious minds when they're absorbing all this symbolism and they're absorbing all the stuff that's being embedded into the recordings as well. I mean, that's a whole different subject area right there.
Right. And I've talked to many researchers that have said the same thing, that not only if you want to reach this certain level of it, of success, that not only do you have to be involved with these occult practices, but they have to have something on you. You have to be involved in a blackmail of sorts, to where they have to have evidence of you doing terrible things so they can hold that over you at any time to have more control. Is this something you found in the music industry?
I've come across this suggestion, certainly. I mean, Professor Griff, who was formerly a part of Public Enemy, he's been sort of in and out of that group over the years, but he's become very outspoken in recent years about the true nature of the music industry and what goes on, and he makes no bones about it. He talks very directly of some of the rituals and some of the initiation routines that go on. He's specifically spoken of Puff Daddy, aka P. Diddy, who was closely involved with the notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, in shaping his career. And most people are probably aware that Biggie was gunned down in March 1997, murdered 6 months after Tupac, in almost identical circumstances. So Professor Griff has had a lot to say about P. Diddy and the extent to which he's involved in this whole game. We've not heard much from Puffy P. Diddy in recent years, but back in the 90s, he was a very prominent player, not just as an artist, but also as an industry executive running his Bad Boy Records label, which was affiliated to Arista. And Griff talks of a ritual that he claims P. Diddy had to undergo in order to be initiated into the industry. And it's a ritual that comes out of the Skull and Bones fraternity within Yale University. And apparently a lot of the adepts and the alumni from that university have to undergo this thing. And it involves lying naked in a coffin while you recount your sexual history to your peers who are all standing around the coffin. And, you know, this is the basis of this ritual. So Griff, unfortunately, has not presented any evidence to prove that this was the case, but he's mentioned it in many interviews. And he's been very direct in claiming that this is one such sort of initiation ritual. Then, talking as you were about the hold that these record companies have over their artists, you know, the controllers of the industry, we get into the suggestion of ritual sacrifice of family members or close friends of many of these artists. I've got a whole chapter dedicated to this in Musical Truth Volume 1, where I really delved into the whole thing. So there have been many suggestions that artists who have enjoyed great commercial success at the hands of the industry have had to pay a very heavy price in exchange for it. And this involves, so the claim goes, allowing a close family member or a friend to be sacrificed in exchange for your success going through the roof. Now, people might scoff at this the first time they hear it and claim that it's ridiculous, but when you look at the large number of untimely and unusual deaths that have occurred to close family members of very prominent and successful musicians, you start to see some patterns emerging. A lot of these people have had their mums, their brothers, their sisters, their cousins, a close friend pass away under some very questionable circumstances very suddenly. So it is something that is worth considering. And when you frame it within the context of everything else that we know does go on in the music industry, such as trauma-based mind control, such as these occult rituals that occur in these stage shows, such as some of the backmasked messages that go into recordings, and the signs and symbols that get put out on record sleeves and in pop videos and stuff like this, it suddenly doesn't become too much of a stretch to imagine that the ritual sacrifice of family members may be going on as well, particularly when you extend that out beyond the entertainment industry and you look at what goes on in the world at large with all these terror events which we have going on, all the foreign wars that get started, all the murder and mayhem and madness that goes on all over the world. As I mentioned earlier in the broadcast here, it is the same groups, individuals and networks that control all these events. So should we really be too surprised and should we really consider that they might be beyond offing a family member of one of these key assets that they want to go out there and do their bidding and perpetuate their mind control?
Right. And earlier you were talking about the mind control aspect that a lot of these artists are most likely subject to, probably from an early age, groomed like a lot of these movie stars. But sometimes in some instances, especially lately, it seems that we see some of them breaking their programming or freaking out or having a very public breakdown. You have any thoughts on what's going on there?
Yeah, we've certainly got some great examples of what appear to be artists who have undergone mind control programming, having that programming break down. A classic example that I've cited many times, but again, it bears repeating, is that of Britney Spears. In 2007, when she went a bit crazy and she went into this hair salon and shaved off all her hair, and then she started attacking cars with umbrellas, the mainstream press and the music press were saying, oh, what's gone wrong with Britney? She's gone a bit crazy. But they don't know how close to the mark they were with that comment. I doubt that many of these writers had any comprehension of trauma-based mind control, but Britney Spears came out of the Mickey Mouse Club, which is part of the Disney Corporation, which is deeply satanic, deeply involved in the occult and all kinds of nefarious stuff when you get into the research of what that company is all about. And the Mickey Mouse Club is used as a grooming ground for child stars who are later to become celebrities in their adult life. A lot of the mind control programming that goes on occurs from early childhood. I mean, it's really horrific, but a lot of these kids, these performers, are just born into families where mind control has been present for generations. What you find is that bloodlines and families are very key to this whole story. You have certain family bloodlines that go back many generations, and new generations that come through are put out there in the public eye in various roles so that organized society can be kept within a fairly small grouping of individuals. And it can be much more easily controlled and directed when you know who the key players are and they have allegiances to these different families. So some of these people are pushed into roles in politics or big business or the world of the military. Others are put into roles in entertainment. They might be ushered into the world of television. They might become Hollywood actors. And many of them are groomed to be all-round entertainers and pop stars. Michael Jackson would be a good example of that. Britney Spears would be another one. So she was in the Mickey Mouse Club alongside Justin Timberlake and Christina Aguilera. And all of them went from child stars to becoming stars in their adult life. And a bit later, coming out of Disney, we had Miley Cyrus in a Hannah Montana guise. And then she became a pop star of a type very different to a Hannah Montana persona. So what they do is they win over a fan base of young kids when these artists first come out. And they're all kind of squeaky clean and girl or boy next door and wholesome family values and stuff. And then at a particular point in their career, they just do this switch and they become overtly sexualized. They start pushing agendas. They start pushing symbolism. And at that point, they've already got the fan base intact and the fan base just gets led down whatever path the artist takes them down. And they'll all be under the direction of handlers because these mind control subjects all have handlers. They're often family members, or they might be a significant other, a partner, a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You've got to watch these people very closely because a lot of them are fulfilling the role of a handler who directs everything that this artist ends up doing. So Britney Spears is a great example of what happens when the programming breaks down. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that she was mind controlled from an early age. When she first emerged as an artist, she was adhering to the program, doing everything that was expected of her. But then she went a little bit crazy during those incidents in 2007. And then she disappears out of the public eye for a period. And then when she comes back, she's had the programming topped up. She's ready to go all over again. And we have the new Britney presented to us. We've seen similar situations with other artists. There was an incident with Mariah Carey, who ticks all the boxes as well, especially in terms of some of the symbolism that she's pushed over the years with her record sleeves and her music videos and stuff like this. She was married to a guy named Tommy Mottola, who was a music industry executive coming out of Columbia CBS, her record label. And Tommy Mottola was an artist and a song pitcher himself in the 1960s. And then a bit later on, he became a record company executive and he got paired up with Mariah Carey and became her husband for a short period. Well, many researchers suspect that he was actually acting as her handler. And, you know, he was directing her actions early on. So Mariah Carey underwent this incident in 2001. Where she's said to have had a nervous breakdown and become suicidal. Well, these are all hallmarks of trauma-based mind control programming breaking down. And the subject's conscious mind starting to break through and starting to shatter all these alters, these different personalities that have been programmed into them. Another recent example of this would be Kanye West. When you look into Kanye West's eyes now, if you look at some video footage of him or a photograph, it just looks like there's nobody there. He just looks like an empty shell. He looks like a husk of a human being now, because it just appears to me as if he's been programmed to the point that he's completely lost his humanity. So there was an incident, I think it was 2016, it was around about the time that Trump got voted into office and Kanye became a very vocal proponent of Donald Trump. And he was doing this concert in Sacramento, California, and he just started rambling incoherently on the mic, which is not the first time he's done that. Kanye is known for being outspoken and just making some very ambiguous comments. And after this particular event, where he's just ranting for several minutes and he's making comments like Jay, referring to Jay-Z, who was kind of his mentor, he put him on in the industry, you know, Jay-Z was Kanye's original mentor, and he's saying, Jay, don't be sending those killers up in my head now. He's talking as if, you know, he's got mind control stuff being put into his head, and as if Jay-Z is some kind of handler that's causing it all to happen. And then he's saying, you know, I'm on my Trump shit, and he's supporting Donald Trump and stuff like this. And he's just rambling incoherently for several minutes. And then when he finishes, Kanye gets forcibly led off stage and handcuffed to a gurney and led off to who knows where. Although my guess would be that it may well be Cedars Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, because this is a facility that has come up time and time again in my research as most probably housing some kind of covert mind control facility, because a very large number of celebrities and famous people generally have been rushed to Cedars Sinai Medical Center in LA. I would suggest there's a lot more to know about that place. So then Kanye disappeared out of the public eye for a few months, and then he comes back, and it's as if he's had his programming topped up and he's all ready to go again, and we get the new Kanye. And what's more, when he reemerged, he's got newly dyed blonde hair, like peroxide blonde hair. And this is a pattern that I've noticed as well. Often when these artists disappear off the scene and they come back again, they have this new look, and it often involves dyed blonde hair. So some examples of that would be Miley Cyrus, who rocked that particular look. Katy Perry, at one point in her career, sort of went out the public eye and came back with newly dyed blonde hair. Same thing happened with Justin Bieber. We got the example there of Kanye West. We could think of Eminem, who right from the start of his career came out with the peroxide blonde hair. And there was an article on the Vigilant Citizen site a while back where the writer is speculating that this is some kind of code to those in the know that this individual has had their programming topped up and they're ready to go again. It's hidden symbolic language for those who know what to look for. So as you can see, this is all pretty dark stuff, and it's very far from fun entertainment. But unfortunately, it is the truth of what goes on in these industries. And I go to great lengths in my books to lay out the different methods and tactics that are used. And it's down to people whether they take that on board or whether they continue to think of these people as having their best interests at heart.
Now, we've heard of weaponized frequencies, and we know certain tones and musical notes can draw a certain emotional response from people. Are we seeing a combination of this to sort of weaponize music in our modern music?
Well, I think we are, especially in the current age where everything is getting done digitally and electronically. I mean, music has been produced that way for many, many years now. It's a very far cry from the analog recording methods that were used in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, some genres are more obviously affected by this process than others. So electronic dance music obviously gets produced entirely with digital production methods. And this is a genre that I've looked into greatly, particularly in Musical Truth Volume 2. I found very few other writers and researchers have been asking questions about dance music. And my area of interest with this is taking it all the way back to the late 80s, when we had this movement known as Acid House, the rave scene, which emerged in the UK. Free parties and festivals with all this exciting new dance music, which was very different to anything that had gone before. And it paved the way for what we now have, which is the worldwide electronic dance music scene that's popular literally in every corner of the world. But to a very large extent, it all had its roots out of this British scene that kicked off around about 1988. And I've drawn a lot of parallels between that and the earlier scene of the 1960s with what happened with the counterculture psychedelic hippie scene. There you had LSD and psychedelic rock music. 21 years later, in the UK, you had the emergence of these new forms of electronic dance music, and you had ecstasy, which is otherwise known as MDMA or E, and that was the new drug of choice. And actually, in my research, there's a lot to show that the ecstasy that was coming out of the UK and was cropping up in all these dance parties was coming out of the security services, MI5 and MI6, in exactly the same way that the LSD was all coming out of the CIA. So that particular scene bears some looking at in terms of what could be going into these recordings now as production methods get ever more sophisticated. And I think it's very interesting to consider sound frequencies and the effect that they could be having on human minds and, you know, human vibrational frequencies. So with production methods now, we have systems like MP3 encoding. And what happens there is a master recording with a full frequency range gets reduced to a more manageable file size so it can be easily shared. And the process involves stripping away aspects of the recording which are imperceptible to the human mind on the receiving end. So the process is removing maybe certain parts of the bass line or certain frequencies, and the recording still pretty much sounds the same to the end user listening to it, and the mind sort of fills in the blanks and replaces the parts of the recording that have been deleted by the MP3 encoding process. So it occurs to me that if these elements of a recording can be taken out and nobody really notices, then the opposite must also be the case, meaning that you can strip into electronic digitally produced recordings certain frequencies and certain elements that, again, the human mind, the human ear is not going to pick up on. So they could be having a very profound subliminal effect on people on the receiving end of it. And if we apply that to what we now have with electronic dance music festivals, which are taking place on a massive scale, or they were before the current lockdown anyway. I mean, just to go back to what I mentioned earlier, this is one of the reasons why I am of the belief that the current lockdowns are a temporary measure. There's a lot of doom mongers out there saying this is it now. We're never going to get our freedoms back. This is the big push. I don't feel that is the case because of how much the controllers have invested in all these different aspects of society. You know, they mind control us through Hollywood films. They mind control us through television. They've got so much invested in the food and drink industry and the medical industry and all these different walks of life. They like us going out and buying material stuff and all these different brands. And they've invested a lot in pushing transhumanism and artificial intelligence ideas through all these electronic dance music festivals on a massive scale all around the world. So I don't believe that that's all over. These things are going to return because of the potential that they have for mind controlling large numbers of people. So when you look at what attendees of these festivals are being exposed to, you've got a combination, a cocktail of influences. You've got the sounds, but you've also got the visuals that get flashed up on the screens at these things. And it's the same old occult signs and symbols that we see in pop videos. You're getting spiritual, metaphysical kind of ideas, religious ideas. You're getting UFO and alien symbology beamed up at the at these events. Then you've got the drug, narcotic element that many of these young people attending these events are being exposed to as well. Ecstasy is everywhere still, the MDMA, the E. There's other drugs in attendance too, mind altering, altering the chemical makeup of the brain. So when you've got a combination of the drugs, the visuals, and the frequencies coming out of the electronic music, the potential there for shaping and molding somebody's perceptions and belief systems and getting right inside their subliminal mind and planting stuff is absolutely immense. So I think that's what we've been seeing with these big events, and I don't for a moment believe that they're going to leave it alone. So these things are going to return.
And the youth today, and always since this started, has always been a major target for the music industry, movie industry. But it seems that now we have social media, and it's kind of like the new drug that they're rolling out for the younger generations to get hooked on. And it can encompass so much and involve so much and feed so much of this imagery and occult, this occult aspect into the minds of the younger people. You can see a difference already in the way that the younger generations have become because of the implementation of social media and all these things that can kind of connect the music industry, the TV industry, and all these things together.
Yep. The controllers of these industries have always been interested in the hearts and the minds and the souls of young people. Young people are so malleable. They're so easy to control. And one key way that they always do it is to try and pit young people against their parents' generation. They like to give them a scene or a culture or a movement or a way of life that they see as theirs. And they like it that their parents don't understand. They like it that their parents disapprove. They've been doing this forever, you know. You can think back to Jim Morrison and his dad. The idea there was that Jim was this rebel that didn't espouse his parents' values, and he was anti-establishment. He was a rebel, and his father didn't understand it because he was from a different generation. And they just keep updating this dynamic from era to era. So now you've got young people that are into social media, as you say. They're hooked on Instagram and Snapchat. And one thing this is doing is shortening attention spans, I've noticed, because young people are just used to having everything at their disposal on demand by way of their smartphones wherever they go. And again, I don't believe that these lockdowns are going to last forever, because this is something else that they've spent too much time working on, too much time perfecting and getting just right. They like it that young people are out there sharing what they're doing on Snapchat and getting bored after just a few seconds. This is something that I've noticed feeding into the DJ world as well. I don't really DJ at gigs much anymore because I just can't stand the music. And I've been there, done that anyway. I did it for 20 odd years as my main career. But one thing I did notice towards the end of doing my regular gigs was that attention spans in clubs are severely diminished compared to what they once were. So when I first started out DJing nearly 30 years ago, as a DJ in control of your crowd, you could drop a tune at the right point in the night and you'd get a cheer, you'd get a great reaction, and people would be happy to respond and dance to that record for a few minutes. Fast forward 20 odd years later, you can drop a new tune in, you bring it in, people recognize the opening notes and they will still cheer and they'll still greet it enthusiastically. But you can notice their attention and their enthusiasm starting to wane literally after about 30 seconds. And when you go to a club now, or when you could still go to clubs, you notice DJs, particularly in the urban music genre. So what passes for hip-hop and R&B, it's not hip-hop and R&B, but that's what they still call it. You know, it's satanic garbage now. But you go to one of these clubs where these styles are being played, and the DJ is changing the record literally every 30 seconds. They're just bringing in a verse and a chorus, and then they've got to change it. And the reason they change the record so quickly is because the crowd is getting bored. The dance floor energy starts to wane after about 20 or 30 seconds. And this is because young people have been entrained to want everything right now and to crave constant stimulation of the senses. And this is a byproduct of the social media era, and it's a byproduct of smart devices and having everything on the go, on the move. as you go about your business. Snapchat is to blame for this. Instagram is to blame for this. Constantly having to update what you're doing and just needing these different stimulants all the time. So that's something I've noticed as a cultural phenomenon of these times. And once again, going back to it, I think this is reason to assume that they're going to still want young people out there attending events and getting exposed to all these different stimulants, because they've invested so much into taking things this far, they're not just going to shut it all down now. I think if there's any positivity or hope to be gained from all of this, it's that at least we are going to get a return to organized society. It's going to be laden with many pitfalls. It's going to come with many threats and dangers that we all need to be alert and vigilant to. But it is possible to get up to speed on what all these things are, and it is possible to avoid falling into the traps if you just pay attention to what's really going on and apply critical thought.
And to try and kind of stay on the positive side, a lot has come out lately. A lot has come to light about the pedophilia, about the dark practices in Hollywood and the music industry. There has been arrests made. There have been a lot of people waking up to it. Do you see any time in our future that it will be completely exposed?
I think we've got the best opportunity right now in the wake of all this COVID-19 madness. We've got the best opportunity that we've ever had to win over large numbers of people who have never questioned the true nature of their existence before. People who have only ever taken their news from mainstream sources. People who have believed what government ministers have told them. We're living in such strange times right now with this lockdown all over the world that people really are starting to question what the hell is going on, because it's not making a whole load of sense. There are so many things about what we're being told regarding this coronavirus so-called pandemic that just don't add up. You know, people die of the flu every single year, and many, many times more people die of the flu than we're being told have died of the coronavirus. And there's also a lot of evidence to show that the figures are getting vastly inflated on this thing as well. And people that are seemingly passing away of all kinds of different causes are having it chalked up as having died of the coronavirus, so as to increase the hype and propaganda value of the whole thing and scare people into accepting that this thing is real and doing everything that the government is telling them they've got to do in the wake of it. But you know, just the fact that so many people die of the flu every year and it goes unreported, it's just not considered something worthy of mainstream media headlines. And yet now all we're hearing about is this coronavirus thing, and it's literally shut down the entire world. I mean, when has anyone ever heard of all the governments around the world agreeing on the same thing at the same time before? It's never happened. And yet you look at what's going on in the world, and exactly the same lockdown measures and social distancing rules and all of this are being applied in countries all over the world. Now, that's got to tell you something. That's got to tell you that these governments are not operating independently. They're not making their own decisions. They're getting these instructions sent down to them from some higher up power. And this alone indicates that governments don't run countries. Boris Johnson doesn't run the United Kingdom. Donald Trump is not in control of America. They're just figureheads. They're puppets that are put out there as the public face of things. But it's obvious from what's going on right now that there are higher powers directing what's going on. And this has got to be causing people to reevaluate their view of the way the world is structured. So the situation we find ourselves in has great potential to win over large numbers of people who've never looked at alternative information before. And this is what we need. We need the numbers to come on board. Because with what I do, with the books that I put out and the public talks that I do and the radio shows that I do, often I get the impression that it's just the same small community of truth seekers that attend these events, that listen to these radio shows, and you're just, to a very large extent, preaching to the choir, to the converted, people that already know that the world is not as we're told it is. The only way the dynamic in our reality is ever really going to change is if large numbers of people who've never looked at this information before start to look at it for the first time. And we all started somewhere, right? I mentioned to you earlier that 10 years ago, I got on this path. If you'd caught me 15 years ago, I would probably still believe everything the government told me. I would probably still be buying newspapers and looking at the BBC News and swallowing it all. But look at where I am now, because I was prepared to apply a bit of critical thought to the situation that I found myself in, and I was prepared to ask questions. So there's hope and there's potential for anyone to embark on that path towards uncovering truth. And the situation that we're in right now offers the best chance we've ever had. So if you start with questioning what we're being told about this virus, and you start looking at the many anomalies and discrepancies behind it, then you have to, if you're going to follow the reasonable path beyond that, you have to start asking yourself, well, what else have we been lied to, and what else isn't as it's been presented to us over the years? And that opens up a whole load of different rabbit holes to explore.
Yeah, the awakening that's going on right now is really amazing. I've seen many people that I never thought would come around questioning things. That is a very encouraging part of this. And Mark, thank you so much for coming on tonight. Before you head out, tell us a little bit about your newest book, The Cause and the Cure.
Sure. Well, this was a bit of a departure for me because it's my first attempt at writing fiction. So I've put out four books, actually. The first one was Tales from the Flip Side in 2007. And that was not what you would refer to as a conscious read by any stretch of the imagination. It was when I was still out there working as a DJ, and it was a collection of funny stories and anecdotes from the sharp end of the DJ game. So then my next book was Musical Truth Volume 1, which I put out in 2016. And that was a pretty massive book, 170,000 words, that brought together 5 years worth of research, everything that I'd come to discover by that point about the true nature of the corporate music industry. Then there was Volume 2, which I put out in 2018, because there was much more of the story to be told. But for this latest book, which came out just at the very end of 2019, and I had no idea what was just around the corner in 2020, none of us did, I decided to put out a work of fiction. So it's a novel. It's allegorical and symbolic and metaphorical in nature. On the surface of it, it appears to be a murder mystery thriller. It's set in Oxford, England, which is the city I was born and the area that I grew up in. And it's set in 1990. I really wanted to take things back 30 years just to remind people of how different society was back then compared to where we find ourselves right now. So 30 years really isn't that long ago in the grand scheme of things. And yet the technology of the times was so different to what we have now. So a good part of the story is set in a radio station newsroom where I myself worked in 1990. So a lot of it is based on personal experience. And the central character is this radio reporter by the name of Verity Hunter. And that name translates as Truth Seeker. All the names of the main characters are coded, actually, so people can have a lot of fun uncovering the different layers of stuff that I've encoded into there and the symbolism that I've employed, because there's a lot of things that I think you would get out of a second or third read of the narrative that you might miss the first time around. But going back to the technology that was in use in the radio station at the time, the vast majority of it was still analog. This is before computers came in. It was at a time when very few people had cell phones. Most people wanting to make a telephone call when they were out and about would have to stop at a phone box and fumble around for coins in their pocket. That's almost unimaginable to young people right now with Snapchat and Instagram on their smartphone, but that's the way things were done in 1990. Radio stations were using reels of tape and cassettes and playing records off of vinyl. Just imagine that. So I've got a lot of period detail from 1990 into the narrative. I had a lot of fun with the nostalgic aspects of it. But beneath the surface, so you've got this series of murders that's occurring around Oxford. And, you know, it could be viewed as quite similar to Inspector Morse or an Agatha Christie murder mystery or something like that. But there's a lot more to it. And I was inspired in that by very much the films of Stanley Kubrick, because researchers have really delved into much of the stuff that he encoded into his films. And a Stanley Kubrick film could easily be watched 4 or 5 times, and you would uncover different layers of stuff that you'd missed on the 4th or 5th viewing. So I wanted a read of this book to be like that. And so I've put a lot of spiritual knowledge in there. I've put a lot of natural law and hermetic teachings. There's a lot of stuff about karma and consequence and cause and effect, hence the title, The Cause and the Cure. And I think someone with some kind of grounding in these occult traditions and teachings could have a real field day uncovering the stuff that I've put into this book. So I'm very happy with how it turned out. I think it puts across a lot of teachings, a lot of wisdom, a lot of knowledge, if people will read it in the right way. But even if somebody is approaching it without any of this background knowledge, I like to think it would come across as a thrilling kind of read, and people would also enjoy a nostalgic throwback to what life was like in 1990, which is a lot simpler and, to my mind, a lot less dark and complex than what life is in 2020.
Very cool. Mark, thank you so much again for coming on tonight. And there's so much more we could talk about, so I will have to have you on in the near future again.
Well, there really is. Yeah, we could talk about so many different aspects of this. It feels like we've only just scratched the surface here.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but anyone wanting to delve into any of these subject areas, there's a lot more to know about all of them. They're right there. Yeah,
and let everyone know where they can find your work, websites, any social media, anything like that.
Sure. Well, my books, Musical Truth Volumes 1 and 2, and also the novel, The Cause and the Cure, are available on Amazon if you want to get them there. I've just recorded an audiobook version of The Cause and the Cure. I've narrated that myself. So if you want to get your book in that form, that's going to be available on audible.com very soon. But if anyone wants to get these books from me direct, actually, at the moment, having said that, I've learned that there is no mail going overseas out of the UK right now. So for listeners in the United States or anywhere outside of the UK, I don't actually have any way of getting mail out to you right now. Ordinarily, I can post out signed copies of these books. So once these ridiculous draconian restrictions are removed, I'll still be able to do that again and post books to anywhere in the world. But for the moment, listeners outside of the UK are restricted to just getting those books on Amazon. I know Amazon isn't the most ethical company in the world and people don't particularly like supporting them, but that's the only way to get the books at the moment until things improve here. Other than that, my YouTube channel is Mark Devlin TV. So that's youtube.com/MarkDevlinTV. There's a whole load of my public talks and lectures up on there, a whole load of my radio interviews and much other material as well. My main website is markdevlin.co.uk, and there's links from there to my various other work.
Very good. And thank you so much again, Mark, and you have a great rest of your evening.
Well, thanks, brother. Yeah, I mean, my scope for doing things in the evening or in the day at the moment is very limited. It consists of really sleeping, and that's about it. But all things must pass, as George Harrison once said, and I do feel that this dreadful situation that we're all in right now will pass sooner rather than later. I'm very optimistic about that.
I have to agree with you. Thanks again, Mark. You have a great night.
All right. Thanks, brother.